KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the program.
Playing cards are thought to have their origins in China over 1,000 years ago. And the classic 52-card deck we know today, with Ace to Ten and Jack, Queen, King, are a largely French version from the 17th century. The humble deck of cards is deeply ingrained in our social fabric. It gives us common sayings about having to play the cards you are dealt, the deck being stacked against you, or someone not being the full deck. "You gotta know when to hold 'em, know when to fold 'em," sings Kenny Rogers. Christa Berg's Spanish Train tells of the Lord and the Devil playing cards for souls of the dead. This is a familiar scenario in folklore from around the world, when people play cards with a stranger who turns out to be the devil, revealed by a cloven foot under a table. It never ends well. Religions have railed against playing cards, as a person's fate should not come down to games of chance, but to higher callings. And there is mystery too as to the deeper symbolism of the deck of cards. Many believe it's based on the calendar. There are four suits for four seasons, 13 cards in each suit matching the lunar cycle, 52 cards for 52 weeks, and if you add up the values of all the cards, plus the Joker, you get 365. Some say this is coincidence. I think not. I mean, what are the odds? Cards have been part of my life since I was 9, when my granddad taught me to play poker and do a dovetail shuffle before dealing. The time I played most was when I was much older and was in 6th year, and my mates Stephen, Ferdia, Paul B, Paul H, Johnny, Michael and I had regular poker sessions. We'd meet in someone's house, our bikes parked around back, have a couple of beers and play for usually modest amounts. Well, there was a comfortable familiarity to these nights, with their own rituals, slagging and banter, our individual fortunes were always moving and shifting. One particular night stands out for me. It was when I cleaned everyone out. No matter who dealt that night, good hands just kept coming, and when they didn't, I either folded in good time, heeding Kenny Rogers' advice, or bluffed like Clint Eastwood or James Bond. At the end of the night, I neatly piled columns of coins in front of me, like the miser Silas Marner in George Eliot's novel, which we were then reading for the Leaving Cert, and counted up the considerable sum of £36. The next morning, I put my hoard in a plastic Quinsworth shopping bag, went to the bookshop on the top floor of Dunleary's shopping centre, scoured the shelves, and picked out 6 books. I'd never gone on a book-buying spree like that before, and never have since, but I knew that's what I wanted to spend the winnings on. I brought my 6 books to the till, put them on the counter, took out my bag and poured out the coins. The bookseller said, dryly, "Poker session?" I can't remember all the titles now, but I do know that one of those books was James Joll's History of Europe since 1870, with portraits on the cover of a host of people that helped define Europe: Karl Marx, Albert Einstein, Queen Victoria, Charles de Gaulle. I remember how struck I was when I first sat down to read it by the clarity of its language and argument. Complex topics were teased out in lucid prose that made sense of a past world while I was trying to make sense of my own. It showed me what history could be like. I loved that book, and still do. I pick it up periodically and flick through its pages, which have passages underlined with a ruler and 18-year-old's comments in the margins. It is a central place in the sitting room, a sort of father figure to the rest of the books on my shelves. Without me, all you others might not be here. Before that poker session, I bought books, but not many. I wasn't really a reader then, or any kind of bookish person. But the morning after that poker session, spending that £36 on books was more important to me than buying records, clothes, or pints on a couple of nights out. I sometimes wonder how things might have worked out if I hadn't bought those books. Maybe the shelves around our house would not be bending under the weight of books. And maybe I'd never have gone on to write my own books or pieces for the radio. Or maybe I would. Maybe it all would have happened anyway, just at another time. But I've learned that in history, nothing is inevitable. There are always particular circumstances required for a seismic change to happen. And maybe mine was a poker session with the lads around a kitchen table on a night when the cards just fell right for me.
On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns of staring out the window at the darkness till boredom overtook us, and he began to speak. He said, "Son, I've made a life out of reading
people." Let's start with a trigger warning. I went to the dentist this week and it was bad. I needed to have a tooth pulled out. It was a molar that had been troublesome for a while, thanks to a small stone in a salad months before, which had managed to crack not the crown that sat over the remaining remnant of tooth, but the remnant itself. The crack was in the root. When I arrived and slid into that big chair, the dentist said he was going to break the crown in half and remove each root at a time, as though he couldn't care less. Then he was over me with a great needle, and I closed my eyes, telling myself the needle was the worst bit, although I had never had a tooth cracked in two and pulled out in pieces, so I couldn't really say. He came back with more needles, and each time he did, the semi-darkness behind my eyelids that the great lamp over the chair was illuminating became a full dark. And on the third needle, when the dark came, a huge and sudden force pushed outwards from my chest, battering at my ribs, so I was amazed the dentist wasn't forced back by it. I realised it was my heartbeat, and that I was on the verge of a panic attack, a first ever panic attack, and I thought, that's it. I'm turning into my mother. I'm going to bite the dentist. That's what Mum did, if you'll believe it. This was years ago, and a different dentist. She was so terrified that she bit down hard on his finger, so hard she made him bleed, and he told her not to come back. Mum had needed many teeth pulled when she was young, and in those days you were held down and there was no anaesthetic, and ever since she had had a terror of dentists that her lifelong problem teeth had ingrained. That day, the day she bit the dentist, something strange happened to her. She wasn't the polite Tunbridge Wells comes to Belfast version of herself that I knew. She did something that was primitive and feral and wholly protective of herself, something wild and violent. Do we all have that button somewhere, buried in us? I did not inherit Mum's fear of dentists, but I dislike sitting in that big chair under that big lamp, and who doesn't? The week before my appointment, I'd held a grim humour about things, muttering to myself that the long trudge towards old crone continued. I decided that because I could joke, it must not really bother me, which is why it was such a surprise when it did. When the dentist and the dark came for a fourth time, I couldn't tell whether I would scream or vomit or follow the maternal line and attack him. But I could not feel the needle. The numbness was beginning to spread. My heart calmed. I noticed that my hands were crossed in my lap and that my feet also were crossed politely. I was holding myself in. I felt sure that if I didn't, my body would melt onto the floor and nothing would be left on that big chair except my teeth. The dentist began to chip at the crown. Then the drill came out. A deep ache had developed in my jaw, and I wondered, did Mum know she was going to bite the dentist right before she did? I complained about the ache, and the dentist gave me a piece of black rubber to bite down on. The pain eased. He continued to drill, and I bit away to my heart's content. We both waited for the crack. Before it came, I had a strange flash of sentimentality for the tooth that had been part of me for over 30 years that I was about to lose. There was a crunching noise, his drill jumped, and I could feel something sitting on my tongue, something the suction tube quickly sucked away. Various metal tools were attempted one by one on the tooth. I had no idea what the dentist was doing, and the worst of it was, I knew he must be pulling, but what I felt in my deeply numbed jaw was that he was pushing down hard. For a second time, a terror flooded me of the noise the tooth would make at the pull. When it came, in the end, there was no noise. I paid the receptionist £100 and went to sit in the bathroom. There was a smudge of blood on my chin and I felt a sudden, childlike need to cry. There was only one person I could call. Hey Mum, are you free to talk?
Tucked in just off Bridgefoot Street in Dublin's Liberties, a battered old green street sign high on a stone wall bears the name Marshalsea Lane, a street that no longer exists. It is also the only indication that these walls are the last remnants of the Four Courts Marshalsea, Ireland's principal debtors' prison, which moved to this location in 1777. These surviving walls belonged to a paved courtyard where the inmates of the prison would while away their endless days playing various ball games. The Marshalsea held debtors whose cases had come before the Court of King's or Queen's Bench. For much of the 18th and 19th centuries, those who couldn't pay their debts could be incarcerated at the behest of their creditors. Although not classed as criminals, they were held as prisoners until their debts were either paid or forgiven. While the threat of ending up in a debtor's prison existed for rich and poor alike, their experience there varied dramatically according to their means. In the Four Courts Marshalsea, master or gentleman debtors could rent rooms which were located in the upper yard of the complex. As the name suggests, the vast majority of these master debtors were men, but there were lady debtors also. The lower yard was used by debtors who couldn't afford to pay for rooms but who could cover their own subsistence. It also housed the third group, the pauper debtors, who were completely dependent on government support. The prison authorities were anxious to keep the inmates of the upper and lower yard segregated, an aspiration which was frustrated by the fact that the gentlemen debtors had to pass through the lower yard to reach their ball court. In his memoir, St. Catherine's Bells, the Dublin merchant Walter Thomas Mailer gives an account of a series of business setbacks that led to him spending some months as a prisoner for debt in the Four Courts Marshalsea during the early 1840s. He describes his fellow gentlemen debtors as an odd assortment of spendthrifts, rogues, and people who'd simply been unlucky in their financial affairs. Mailer had a generous allowance from his family and fitted out his rooms with shelves full of books, a bagatelle table, and what he describes as all the necessaries for a bachelor's household. He also engaged a woman named Margaret Nolan to act as his housekeeper during his stay. He passed much of his time in the ball court playing rackets, a game similar to squash which originally developed in debtors' prisons in London in the 18th century. The ball court seems to have been the centre of social life in the Marshalsea, and it contained a gallery where prisoners and outside visitors could watch matches. Mailer wrote that, wishing to make himself at home in his new community, he purchased a racket and balls and learned to become adept at the game. He said he joined in most matches and continued playing about 4 hours a day. While the ball court was usually a source of great conviviality within the Marshalsea, an altercation one afternoon between Mailer and another prisoner named Michael Staunton almost proved fatal. Michael Staunton was the mixed-race son of a Captain Staunton who had been engaged in the West Indian sugar trade. He was left a large fortune by his father, but according to Mailer, never called stop until he dissipated away all his money and he eventually found himself in debtor's prison. On the afternoon in question, Staunton accused Mailer and his companions of monopolising the court in contravention of the agreed customs of the prison. A large group of prisoners and visitors in the observation gallery witnessed Mailer's response, in which he called Staunton a liar. Staunton reacted by attacking Mailer, grabbing him in what Mailer described as a bear hug. Mailer shook Staunton off and challenged him to a duel in the Marshalsea's upper yard, apparently one of the necessaries of the bachelor's household, which he had brought with him, was a pair of duelling pistols. On hearing the melee, Bat Sullivan, an older and much beloved long-term resident of the Marshalsea, intervened. Following some negotiations, both Staunton and Mailer agreed to withdraw their intemperate remarks. Bat Sullivan then mentioned that he had been sent in a beautiful, fresh turbot fish that very day and insisted that the former belligerents join him and some of the other prisoners that evening for dinner. Sullivan also sent out an invitation to his wife, daughters and some other ladies to visit the prison that evening and join the party. One of the prisoners played the violin and Staunton's rooms, which were located opposite Sullivan's, were thrown open for a dance. The party didn't break up until daylight, and among the guests was Joseph Dennis Mullen, the genial governor of the Marshalsea. The Four Courts Marshalsea closed in 1874. For a while, the building served as a barracks for the Dublin militia, before later becoming a warren of tenements. It was demolished in the 1970s, with the exception of the ball court, which survives, along with memories of hard-fought games and hot-headed players.
The pulse of an Irishman never beats quicker when war is a story or love is a theme. And place him where bullets fly thicker and thicker, you'll find him all poverty scorning. And though a motion may go there, light up the heart you ride his own. Fortune is cruel, but war of
In 1989, I began what could be called my independent life, and I moved into my first bedsit, a small single room in an old, crumbling Georgian house. It must have been a maid's room originally. The width of the room was little more than one person's outstretched arms. It was obvious from the tiny fireplace, which incidentally was the only source of heat, that a servant's comfort wasn't exactly a top priority 200 years ago. My new home boasted a single cold tap and a gas meter, which you had to keep well fed with 50 pence pieces if you didn't want the gas to cut out in the middle of cooking your dinner. A nice line of damp running down the corner of the wall behind the bed. A shower in the basement and a bath in the attic. Two toilets for the whole house, shared among eight other flats. A public phone in the hall. And, finally, a carpet and wallpaper pattern so shocking that even looking at it for too long could induce a dizzy spell. Being a young freelance actor, I lived more or less hand-to-mouth. The weekly food shop was supplemented by monthly butter vouchers. I collected the fuel allowance each Tuesday, out of which I had to buy a week's briquettes. However, you couldn't light the fire before midday, as the grate was too small to keep it burning freely for more than 5 or 6 hours. If you wanted to keep the room warm on winter evenings, you had to let the fire go out and wait for the grate to cool, then lay and light the fire all over again. The alternative was to go to bed at tea time with a hot water bottle, something which I occasionally did. The luxury of a television was way beyond what I could afford in those days, not to mention the license that went with it. But I did manage to acquire a small second-hand black-and-white portable for two-channel viewing from a kind friend. This TV was so small I could fit it into my oven, which is exactly what I did whenever the TV license inspectors called around. Whenever my doorbell rang after 6 p.m, I'd just automatically unplug the television and pop it in the oven before letting them in. Unusually enough, The landlords lived on the premises. They were an elderly couple from the country and a little eccentric, but very kind and caring. Once I returned from being away to find that my landlord had replaced my plain cream curtains with orange and brown patterned ones. This was his gift to me. These curtains assaulted my senses like a sledgehammer, but the landlord's anticipation of my pleasure was so immense I hadn't the heart to crush him. As soon as he left, I burst into tears. Now the only place left for me to rest my eyes was the back of the white-painted door. Remembering that couple and their many kindnesses, I realized they were never less than well-intentioned. I often thought some of their tenants took the place of the children they never had. The rest of the house's inhabitants consisted of an odd collection of souls. One of my more vulnerable neighbours kept a snorkel beside the bath. I'm not quite sure what role this piece of equipment played in her nightly routine, but I never asked. In time, some well-intentioned civil servants and politicians decided that shared bathrooms were unacceptable and bedsits had to go. Unfortunately, any semblance of affordable rent seemed to go along with them. While in no way wishing to romanticize the borderline squalor of some of these places, the fact was that I could afford to live in peace in my little bedsit, and with careful management of my small income, remain debt-free. The bedsit gave way to the studio, which is a bedsit in all but name, only without the advantage of affordability and access. Renting in the years that followed brought unimaginable levels of stress and insecurity. But even worse is thinking of the many young adults today who will spend their 20s, 30s, and possibly beyond trapped in their childhood bedroom. I look back fondly on those 5 years in that bedsit out of which I made a home. I think of the little grate, the psychedelic curtains, the telly in the oven. And I just remember being so happy.
It's amazing how we Irish turn up everywhere in history, and no place more so than in France. Saint Fiacre of the early Irish Celtic Church left his hermitage in Kilkenny and turned up in Broye, France, and became famous as a herbalist. He died there in 670. He's the patron saint of gardeners, and his relics are venerated in Meaux Cathedral in northern France. Meaux was a great centre of devotion to Saint Fiacre, especially during the 17th and 18th centuries. He had a reputation, believe it or not, for healing hemorrhoids, known as Saint Fiacre's figs. Queen Anne of Austria visited his shrine and praised him for curing her husband. Cardinal Richelieu also visited, hoping for a cure. The saint also gave his name to the horse-drawn carriages called fiacres that could be hired at Hotel Saint Fiacre in the Rue Saint-Martin in Paris. As a result, he is also the unofficial patron saint of taxi drivers. As you travel around France, you will find many streets and squares named after Saint Fiacre. The French might be speaking Dutch now, if not for the Irish Brigade's attack at the crucial 1745 Battle of Fontenoy. They saved the day by their surprise charge out from the woods when things were going very badly for the French. The fight was against an alliance of the Dutch, Hanoverians, and English, commanded by the Duke of Cumberland. The Irish Brigade's hurrah as they charged was, "Remember Limerick," to recall the Treaty of Limerick and the subsequent bad faith of the Williamite English forces. In the following century, a Fenian rallying cry was, "Remember Fontenoy." It is today a small village on the French-Belgian border, where you can see a fine Celtic cross put there in 1907 and a plaque installed by Irish Americans from San Francisco who were also remembering Fontenoy. Around the same time as the Battle of Fontenoy, a young émigré Irish doctor, Jean-Baptiste McMahon from Limerick, arrived in Vézelay, Burgundy, to treat an elderly Count Moray. The patient eventually died, but his young wife, Charlotte, had taken a fancy to the young Irish doctor and married McMahon, who thus became extremely rich. His grandson, General Patrice McMahon, became president of the Third French Republic in 1872. His descendants continued to live in the Chateau de Souilly near Autun in Burgundy. It's open to the public. Vézelay was also where many French artists lived in the early 20th century. Before Picasso and his circle turned to the south of France, Vézelay, 2 hours train ride from Paris, was where it was at. Christian Zervos, who was a great patron of the arts and publisher of the Cahiers des Arts, also lived there. He encouraged artists and bought their paintings. He hired Jean Badovici and his Irish partner, architect Eileen Gray from Wexford, to redesign and renovate his farmhouse La Goulotte on the outskirts of Vézelay. Badovici and Eileen went on to renovate 3 other houses in Vézelay before moving south to the Cap Martin, where they built the famous modernist E1027 villa. W.B. Yeats died just around the corner in Roquebrune in 1939, the same year that Corbusier was painting dubious murals on the interior walls of Eileen's villa. So, following on that great Hiberno-French tradition of integration, I lived for a while in a small village not far from Vézelay. Feeling the need to better integrate, I asked to speak at a seminar of the local Dry Stone, Pierre Seiche, society. I knew a bit about dry stone walls in Ireland, as anyone who travels to the west of Ireland will do. In the town hall of Avalon, I got up to speak about the dry stone building tradition in Ireland. I started, as you do, with the Quai de Fields, dwelled a lot on the early Irish church buildings such as Galeris Oratory and Skellig Michael, and went on up to the arrival of the Normans and then the current stone walls. I noticed a particularly animated person in the front row, and when question time came, he stood up and asked in French if I knew a certain Professor Harbison of the Royal Irish Academy and a paper he had published in 1972 casting doubt on the early date for Galeris and intimating that there are traces of mortar in the oratory if you look hard enough, not dry stones. This French scholar then went on to claim that the beehive huts on Skellig Michael were in fact built in the 19th century to store gunpowder and for shelter when the lighthouse was being built. It turned out that he also has a website that casts doubt on the early Irish church and the myths surrounding it. I countered by mentioning San Fiacre as an aspect of the early Irish church we could surely all agree on. The scholar got even more hot under the collar. "Don't get me started," he said. Sometimes it's hard to separate myth from reality, but at least look out for Fiacre next time you're in France.
The young man looks at me, somewhat bewildered. "The Great Gatsby," I repeat. "By F. Scott Fitzgerald." Still the blank gaze. And it's then that the woman on my side of the counter steps in to help. One stream of Mandarin later, and before I know it, The male shop assistant is out like a greyhound from behind the bookshop counter, has picked up a stepladder and is propping it up against a wall of books that climbs so high that it actually hurts my neck to peer to the top. 1 minute later, and the young man descends, grinning triumphantly and waving the green-covered paperback book in his hand in my direction. The Great Gatsby it is, in Chinese. It's September 2018 and I'm in Beijing, and determined to feed my obsession by adding to my already sizable collection of different editions of Fitzgerald's masterpiece. How much of an obsession? Well, the current count now stands at 28. Yes, 28 different copies of F. Scott Fitzgerald's third novel are currently residing side by side on one very long bookcase shelf. Among those are the book from Beijing, two Italian editions, one bought in Sicily and the other in Rome, a French version, Gatsby Le Magnifique, purchased in Nice, El Gran Gatsby, bought in Madrid, and then there's my unpronounceable, to me at least, Greek version, procured a few years ago from the somewhat bemused owner of a little bookshop in the former Cretan capital of Hania. The other 22 are all in English, from various publishers, in various sizes, and with various types of cover. From a beautiful hardback Penguin Classic edition, all elegance and decorative gold swirls, to a garish Pulp the Classics edition, complete with artwork depicting a Philip Marlowe detective type in belted raincoat, and with a line below the title declaring, in bold type of course, "When it came to loving, he knew which daisy to pick." Yes, really. That's what it says. I can't quite remember how it all started. I know that I first read The Great Gatsby as a young teenager and fell in love with the writing. For what's not to love about the sheer, evocative magic of the writing? As Fitzgerald transports us, for example, to this particular Gatsby party. In his blue gardens, men and girls came and went like moths among the whisperings and the champagne and the stars. The bars in full swing and floating rounds of cocktails permeate the garden outside until the air is alive with chatter and laughter and casual innuendo and introductions forgotten on the spot and enthusiastic meetings between women who never knew each other's names. Suddenly there you are, wandering among the glitz and the glamour, the backstabbers and the bootleggers, the vacuous and the vainglorious, and all on a warm summer's night in Jay Gatsby's garden on New York's Long Island Sound. The clinking of glasses, the beaded flapper dresses, the men in white flannel trousers, the long cigarette holders dangling from female hands with perfectly painted nails. An image of beauty and perfection, of friendship and gratitude, of love and loyalty, that is so superficial, so meaningless, that it decimates countless lives, not least Jay Gatsby's among them. For such a slim volume, The Great Gatsby packs quite a punch. For what F. Scott Fitzgerald shines a light on, what he parades before our eyes, is a society on the skite. An ephemeral world, the boom before the bust. It's a picture of greed and glamour, of people who live only for the moment and for themselves. Careless people, as the novel's narrator Nick Carraway describes his cousin Daisy, the object of Jay Gatsby's desires, together with Daisy's loud, rich oaf of a husband, the stomach-churning Tom Buchanan. And if ever there was a lesson to be learned about the fallout of acquiring money for money's sake, then that lesson is writ large in the story of Jay Gatsby himself. The emptiness, the surrounded by people loneliness, the pointlessness of it all. And yet, what draws me back again and again to the novel is actually Gatsby himself. Yes, he's a fraud and a bootlegger, but just under that quietly arrogant surface, we also get a glimpse of a man who could be so much more. For here is someone who values both loyalty and love. And here too, above all and despite everything, is a man who dares to hope, that he can recapture the past, that Daisy will once again be his, that he will find true happiness. Even as a teenage reader, I somehow got the importance of that, what Fitzgerald describes as Gatsby's extraordinary gift for hope. And so I keep returning to Long Island Sound, rereading the novel every summer, and seeking out new editions whenever and wherever I can, even those in languages that I don't understand. For what better a gift can there be than Jay Gatsby's gift for hope? For it's hope, after all, that offers us comfort, that keeps us afloat, and that drives us to beat on, boats against the current, daring to dream of better times ahead.
On this morning's programme, we heard Poker Nights by Tim Carey. That Big Chair was by Rebecca Hunter. The Four Courts Marshall Sea and The Battle of the Ball Court by Brian Crowley. The Bedsit by Jessica Freed. Dry Stone Walls and San Fiacre by Frank Kavanagh. And Boats Against the Current by Rosalind Dee. The music was The Gambler by Kenny Rogers. The main theme from Jaws by John Williams. The Pulse of an Irishman from Beethoven's Irish Songs, sung by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. Bedsit by Soft Cell. And Skellig, composed by Alva McDonough and performed by her on cello, with Orla McDonough on piano. And a concert you may be interested in, this Thursday, the 10th of April, The Great Gatsby turns 100 and the RTE Concert Orchestra, Guy Barker and guests are celebrating the centenary with a night of music from the jazz age at the National Concert Hall. You'll find ticket information at rte.ie/co. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back on the RTE Radio app, on the programme website, or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
Sunday morning, told me you were through. It was on that Sunday morning, you told me you were through. It took me seven long days to lose my blues for you. It was a blue Monday morning, I was crying all day long. Blue, blue, blue Monday morning, crying all day long. I couldn't sleep while thinking about you, baby, that second night that you were gone. Woke up Tuesday morning, didn't even want to go to my work. Woke up Tuesday morning, didn't even want to go to my work. Didn't even comb my nappy hair. Put me on a rough-dry shirt, a rough-dry shirt. Thank you.
baby. I walk the streets till Friday night. So blue for my baby. I walk the streets till Friday night. It was early Saturday morning, the day when I first saw the light. I saw the light. Sunday morning, Sunday morning, found me a love that's new. Sunday morning, Sunday morning, I found me a love that's true. It took me 7 long days to lose my blues for you.
Just tell me, baby, what can I do to change your mind? Yeah. Baby, can I change your mind? I got the freight train and the tracks is out. You said you love me, and I believe in you. You're trying to quit me, what more can I do? Yeah. Baby, what more can I do? Some old day you're gonna want me, and I won't care a thing about you. You got a man in the east, a man in the west, just sitting here wondering who you love the best. Hey, hey, baby, what can I do to change your mind? I got the blues for you, baby, you keep me worried all the time. Pick 'em, boy, pick 'em, pick 'em, pick 'em. I've been loving you, baby. I've been loving you, baby. Just tell me, what more can I do? Yeah. What more can I do? Goodbye, goodbye, baby. I'm leaving you.
Lord, seem like I heard somebody. I received a letter this morning. I have a long to the telephone. Lord, I received a letter this morning, baby. I belong to the telephone. Lord, a letter from my baby done been here and gone. If the good Lord spare me, let to get my business straight. If the good Lord spare me, baby, let to get my business straight. I'm gonna bid farewell, darling, to old Southern State. Where was you, darling, when the rooster crowed for day? Lordy, where was you when the rooster crowed for day? You know I won't at home. You know I won't at home, baby. But darling, you know I was on my way. I've been drove from door to door. Lord, I've been mistreated. I've been drove from door to door. Sometime I wonder, baby, where am I to go? Sometime I wonder how my baby rests at night. Oh, sometime I wonder have my baby rest at night. Lord, you know, you know the baby ain't treating me right. Oh, yeah.
Thank you. while you're walking down the street. You was holding someone else's hand. You told me it was only your brother. I just tried to understand, but that ain't right. I tried to believe every word you said. I believe to my soul another man.
You're listening to 8:30 a.m. KSDP in Sandpoint, Alaska.